UOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds. Sufjan Stevens has a song about John Wayne Gacy Jr., the man convicted of murdering 27 boys and burying them under his house. At the end of the song, Stevens has this confession.
And in my best behavior, I am really just like him. Look beneath the floorboards for the secrets I have hid.
In his new book, Free Will, Sam Harris writes that under certain conditions, he would be a brutal killer, but he's not. Sam Harris is the author of the best-selling book, End of Faith. He has a degree in philosophy and a PhD in neuroscience. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ross. Happy to be here.
We'd all like to think that we would not be mass murderers. We have free will. We choose not to. You argue we're mistaken. Why is that?
Yeah, well, the problem is no one has ever described a way that physical and mental events can arise in this world that would attest to the existence of free will. I mean, none of us made our minds. You didn't build your brain. You didn't pick your genes. You didn't pick your parents. You didn't pick the environmental influences that sculpted the microstructure of your brain over the course of your lifetime. Therefore, you didn't pick your desires and your biases and your proclivities and your intelligence. There's nothing about you that you are the author of. And the next thought or intention that arises in consciousness is something which just arises and which you don't know is going to arise until it arises. So even subjectively, free will is not in evidence. And this is one of the things that's novel about my argument, I think, is that most people think we have this robust experience of free will and that we just can't map it on to physical reality. It's just we know that we are the authors of our thoughts and intentions and actions, but when you actually look at how thoughts and intentions and actions arise based on neurophysiology and how that's dependent on the previous states of the universe, then you can't make sense of how free will fits in. But the truth is, even subjectively, our experience is completely compatible with determinism. You don't know what you're next going to think until you think it.
Does that mean that we don't have the ability to choose to do good over evil?
Well, we have. I mean, this doesn't negate everything about us that we value happily. We have. There's a distinction between voluntary and involuntary action. There's a distinction between the kinds of responsibilities we can ascribe to an adult and those we can to a child. All of these are important distinctions to make morally and legally. But what changes is that none of that has anything to do with free will. What that has to do with is the full character of your mind and what you're likely to do next. So, for instance, if you decide to kill your neighbor after weeks of deliberation and library research and debate with your friends, well, then killing your neighbor actually says a lot about you. It says a lot about the kind of mind you have and the kinds of things you are likely to do in the future. If you kill your neighbor by accident because you were cleaning your gun and you didn't know it was loaded and a round went off and went out your window and into his, well, then it says nothing about you except for the fact that you're negligent and probably can't be trusted to handle a firearm. But they say very different things about who you are and your inner life. But you don't need free will to tell that story. All you need to do is talk about the role that intentions and conscious thought play in human life.
Sam, you mentioned involuntary actions and voluntary actions. What's the difference between a voluntary action and the exercise of free will?
Let me just turn that question around, because you're basically saying, so what? Well, even if we admit that voluntary action is also just part of the functioning of a universe of prior causes, which we can't ultimately be the author of, and you didn't make your intelligence, you didn't make your moral intuitions, you didn't create your genes or yourself, and therefore your voluntary actions are the product of prior causes that you didn't create. So what does that get you? Well, it gets you a few things. It gets you, it's actually a way of overcoming hatred, because hatred doesn't make any sense once you give up the idea of free will. You can fear certain people. I mean, there's certain dangerous people who we want to lock up because they're intent upon harming us, and that makes sense. But once you take away this idea of free will and you see that you would be exactly like those people if you traded places with them, atom for atom, then hatred goes away. And so then it's like with a grizzly bear, you know, loose in the town, we don't hate it. We rightly fear it, and we want to lock it up, or we might have to shoot it if we can't capture it. So we can be aware of dangers posed by other things in this world without attributing free will to them. And we wouldn't have a retributive justice system that punished grizzly bears based on some righteous feeling that they deserved their punishment. But we would lock them up if that was the only way to keep ourselves safe from grizzly bears. One change is that the basis for hatred falls away, and that all things being equal seems like a very good thing. I mean, the irony here is that if you want to be like Jesus and love your enemies, or at the very least not hate them, one way into that is to actually just view a larger picture of scientific causality, and see that. That people, a psychopath is in fact very unlucky at bottom to be a psychopath, and you can't account for the fact that you are not a psychopath.
I'm talking to philosopher Sam Harris, and his new book is called Free Will. If there is no free will, why do two people, maybe identical twins, in identical situations, act differently?
Well, because they don't have identical brains, and it's just identical twins who are only identical at the level of their genome, but obviously much else about us is put in place after we are conceived, and even in utero things change for identical twins. But you know, over the course of their lives, you begin to see all the ways in which environmental influences determine what a person becomes, and really the division between nature and nurture is somewhat spurious, because it's nurture changes us based on the genes that are available there to be changed. So it's in concert with genetics that nurture works its influence. But there's clearly a difference between identical siblings, and that difference is not obviously genetic. It's the result of environment.
But I guess I'm not clear on it. If I grew up like John Wayne Gacy Jr., if I had his same genes, if I had his same mental attitude, if I'd experienced everything he had, I would do what John Wayne Gacy did. But of course, no one's identical to anyone else.
Right. But if you were identical, if the state of your brain were identical, then that is synonymous with doing, with being John Wayne Gacy. So it's not the problem is just like saying you can never have an identical brain to somebody else, which is in fact may in fact not be ultimately true. If we ever were truly able to crack the neural code and upload our brains onto some other platform, as some computer scientists and cognitive scientists think is at least in principle possible, then we would be talking about what kind of brain, whether two brains in fact could be identical. But in terms of practical reality, no, you're never going to have an identical brain with somebody else, and so there's always going to be this uncertainty as to whether what you would do in precisely that situation with very similar lives running. But we know that you didn't. You can't be responsible for the fact that you are not someone who gets up in the morning wanting to kill kids. I mean, the people who get up in the morning wanting to kill kids didn't choose that about themselves.
But does everybody who wakes up that way go out and do it? I mean, we have lots of violent impulses and thoughts towards things, but for the most part, we resist them.
Well, yeah. So, but then, did you choose? So, you have precisely the level of resistance you have. So let's say you want to go on a diet. I mean, to bring this back to where most people live, you want to go on a diet, and you've tried to go on a diet to lose weight half a dozen times, and sometimes it sort of works, and most of the time it doesn't, or it works, and then you gain back the weight. And you really can't account for why you have precisely the level of willpower you have. you just have what you have. But let's say you get, you know, someone like Tim Ferriss on for the next radio show, and he gives you a pep talk, and he tells you exactly how you should go about this and think about this, and you just find this conversation so transformative that the next day you go on a diet and it really works. You just have a will of steel, right? And now you lose 20 pounds or whatever, and everyone's asking you for advice about how to diet. Now, that change in you is not something you authored. That is, it really is subjectively and objectively mysterious. You can't account for why your conversation with Tim had precisely the effect it did and why it didn't have that effect on one of your listeners. You can't account for why up until this moment you had precisely the willpower you had and not more.
Let me suggest that perhaps it was a conversation with Tim Ferriss or an expert on how to break bad habits that all of a sudden it reinforced my willpower with a technique or a tactic to allow that willpower to take effect.
Yeah, well, so this, again, this is not to say that there aren't intelligent ways to go about changing ourselves. I mean, there are choices matter, and intention matters, and willpower matters. All of this effort matters. All of this is as valuable as we all think it is, except for the fact that you are not, in this moment, you have precisely the tools you have, and you can't account for why you don't have more or less than you do in this moment. So the role of choice matters, but you can't, at bottom, choose what you choose. I mean, the next thought that arises is simply going to arise, and you're not, I mean, to give you a simple example, you think of a famous person. And you have the whole universe of famous people to think of, and just tell me the first one that comes to mind.
Benjamin Franklin.
Okay, so you thought of you don't know why you didn't think of Beyonce or Michael Jackson or anything else along that line of, you know, pop singers. You thought of Ben Franklin. We know that if we were scanning your brain in some kind of idealized neuroimaging experiment, we would have known you were going to think of Ben Franklin half a second or more before you did. I mean, that in principle, that experiment is possible.
I'm glad you said in principle, because it's not as though something hooked up to my brain prints out Ben Franklin before I say Ben Franklin.
Well, no, but in fact, we know in principle that is true, and that has virtually been done for other kinds of decisions. We couldn't tease out your Ben Franklin neurons, perhaps, at the moment, but everything suggests that one day we will be able to, and we can do an experiment where if you're choosing to push the left button or the right button and just taking your time about it, going back and forth between the two, and then you finally make up your mind to push the left or the right, we know whether you're going to push the left or the right before you are consciously aware of which button you're going to push.
That experiment
has been done on many different platforms with EEG and functional magnetic resonance imaging and even direct recording from the cortex in surgical patients. So we know that the conscious mind that thinks it's deciding is downstream of neurophysiological events that are determining what decision gets made. And so your experience of thinking, Ben Franklin, is just appearing in consciousness. I mean, it's almost like I said Ben Franklin. As far as you're concerned, as the locus of conscious life in you, and as a matter of neurophysiology, we know that your Ben Franklin cells got working, and your Beyonce cells didn't for whatever reason. And these are reasons which you can't be aware of, and really at bottom can't take responsibility for. It's a matter of social convention that I would say, well, you're responsible for the fact that you said Ben Franklin. You didn't have to say that. You could have said something more responsible, you know, something more interesting than that, say. But
I thought that was pretty interesting.
You know, these are the kinds of conversations we have with one another. But when we're actually honest about how causality arises and what produces thoughts and behavior, we can't locate the author of our thoughts and actions in the way that we seem to assume, in the way that our legal system seems to assume.
I'm talking to Sam Harris about his fascinating short book called Free Will. You might remember his book, The End of Faith, the new book dedicated to his fellow outspoken atheist, Christopher Hitchens. You're right, we're not in control of our mind because as conscious agents, we only know part of our mind, and you've just kind of explained the parts that we don't know. Well, if science is able to allow us to know those parts we don't know now, will we then have free will? If I'm able to be able to see that I'm going to see Ben Franklin, will I then have the free will to say Beyonce?
Well, no, because again, it's there will always be these first events, these neurophysiological events that are constrained by and caused by previous states of the brain, which you didn't author. I mean, which again, it's like, I mean, it's basically what you're asking is, can we take responsibility for our unconscious mental life
if we know about it?
Understand causality,
yes.
More and more and more. But at no point does that give us. Understanding the human genome perfectly wouldn't suddenly make you feel, aha, well then, so those genes are really my responsibility. I mean, we could see how certain genes are being relentlessly transcribed and causing certain protein products that then have their effect on your conscious mental life. But the more you understand that process, the less likely it is that somehow this feeling of aha, that's me really doing it, is going to spring into being. I mean, it seems to be running the other direction.
Sam, if people really did dispel the illusion of free will, what would be the implications for politics?
Well, I think there are a few. It's because the political, the left and right poles of the political spectrum seem to have a different view of human agency, and the liberal half, the left, actually has some of the wisdom of understanding that people don't make themselves already on board. I mean, liberalism, generally speaking, is very open to the idea that people are deeply influenced by society and genes and their parents and a lot of factors that they didn't pick and which they ultimately can't be blamed for having. And so that the role of luck, the moral role of luck, is pretty salient for liberals. And so they want to have a social safety net that accounts for these really egregious differences in luck. Whereas conservatives seem to often make the notion of individual responsibility a kind of religious fetish, where you are responsible for everything, whether we can make sense of that claim or not. So the idea of a self-made man is really the apotheosis of the conservative worldview. It's like, I did it myself. I had help from no one else. Every person who's ever uttered those self-righteous words has been lying to themselves about many obvious influences on their success.
I mean, Sam, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry, we've just run out of time. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. It's a fascinating read. It will get you thinking about why you do things and why you don't. The book is called Free Will, and the author of it is Sam Harris. David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix. Andy Hurst is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
Good afternoon.